Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 18, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is the very first teaching ever presented by the Buddha. It occurred a few weeks after Siddhartha Gautama awakened and gained full human maturity, complete understanding of the human life experience. Everything that the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of this first sutta, the Four Noble Truths, and Dependent Origination. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Tonight's talk is on the Buddha's very first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The background and the setting is important, and it's also important to remember, I say it often, that everything the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of this first sutta. Siddhartha Gautama awakened, developed a profound understanding that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the way human life actually is, the reality of human life, that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. And that was first taught in the Paticca-samuppada Sutta and many other suttas, known as dependent origination, and it simply describes the origination of our own disappointing experiences in human life. So this first sutta, the Buddha gave about 2 weeks after his awakening. And post his awakening, now the Buddha, he sat in meditation off and on, considering if it was worth teaching what he understood in a way that would be actually useful to human beings. Because he understood the profound and debilitating nature of that initial cause of ignorance. And what follows from a mind rooted in ignorance is to create these very powerful and very subtle and pervasive strategies to ignore your own ignorance, to not see it. It's the essence of ignorance, isn't it? And not just ignorance of Four Noble Truths, any type of ignorance. Ongoing ignorance in the world requires some degree of ignoring what's right in front of you to continue that ignorance. In this case, it's very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so, in considering this, how can I teach this? What tool can I give people to recognize and abandon their own ignorance so they won't continue developing another practice? And he touches on this, developing a so-called spiritual practice that simply allows you to further ignore your own ignorance. And the Buddha studied with all the foremost spiritual teachers of his time and mastered their doctrines very quickly, so much so that they asked him to be their main teacher out in the world. And the Buddha dismissed all that, saying that their teachings didn't lead to his goal. He didn't say they're useless teachings or anything like that. They simply didn't lead to his goal of developing a profound understanding of suffering and the path leading to the cessation of individual contributions to suffering. And that's what he set out here. So he's walking down the road, post his awakening. He understands now what he needs to teach and how to teach it. And wouldn't you know it, that the first people he comes across, well, there was actually, that's not true, there was one individual in between the Buddha running into his friends, and it was someone who challenged the Buddha on what his teaching, and the Buddha very briefly showed him, mostly by the way he was holding himself, that he understood the truth, and they went on their merry ways, the two of them. Then the Buddha comes across the five friends that he had been wandering around northern India with. And they at first shunned the Buddha. They saw him coming. They says, there's that guy that left us. We're just going to ignore him because he's now living this lavish life, meaning he's taking a little bit of food and living in a shelter, possibly, rather than the severe asceticism that they're all practicing. But as the Buddha got closer, they realized that he had attained their goal. He had found what they were all looking for, so they were willing to listen. And the Buddha addressed those five. Immediately he goes to the root problem of wrong views. It's wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. And so he taught a path that begins and ends in right view. The Buddha says, there are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. I mean, in the Buddhist sense, going forth is leaving the home life and going into homelessness, seeking spiritual understanding. In this sense, it's any of us who decide to go forth from our old views and develop right views, develop more clear thinking. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. Of course, that's any kind of craving for or clinging to the things of the world, including our own ideas. This behavior is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. It is devoted to self-affliction, even though we don't realize it. That which is devoted to self-affliction is always painful and ignoble. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata. It's a Buddha's reference to himself. This middle way produces vision and knowledge. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. It's unbinding from wrong views. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm and self-awakening and unbinding? The middle way is precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. I got to go back because I think I missed an important line. No, I thought the part about self-affliction, I wanted to just elaborate on that a little bit. One of the lingering practices that Siddhartha Gautama and these five friends engaged in is severe forms of asceticism. It is said that the Buddha got to the point where he could control his breath, which is one form of asceticism, to the point that most people thought he was dead. It is said that he was living on one bean or one grain of rice a day. The Buddha describes his condition right before he realized how painful this was, that he could touch his spine by touching the front of his belly. He was that emaciated. And the idea, and it's still common today, that if you can deny yourself, whether it's very severe forms of asceticism or sometimes somewhat minor forms of asceticism, somehow you'll free your mind or you'll free your inner Buddha nature. Or because of your denying all of your physical needs, somehow you'll free up your mind. It's almost understandable how you could come to those conclusions when you're pretty confused about the nature of life. But when you think a little bit more about it, we're a mind and a body. The Buddha taught something so completely different from that. He taught how to unite a mind and the body, not figure out a way to escape, if you could, the mind from the body. And some of those practices are prevalent today. Coming up on retreat week, one of the reasons why I don't, and I was on many, many 7 and 10 day silent retreats, never could understand what value I was gaining out of it. Anyway, the reason why I don't teach silent retreats or hold silent retreats is twofold. One is there's no way to listen to the Dhamma and experience the Dhamma. But the other is that forced silence for long periods of time is just another form of asceticism. You're denying one of your senses that are necessary to understand what's going on around you. So again, these forms of asceticism simply aren't part of what the Buddha taught, and he teaches that from direct experience. He tried it didn't work. And so what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm and to self-awakening and unbinding? The middle way is precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. I just said that. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm and to self-awakening and to unbinding. To some people, that last leads to calm, self-awakening, and to unbinding is almost too mundane to even care too much about. Until you realize it's really what we all are after, isn't it? How can I develop a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring in the world? And that's exactly what the Buddha taught. And in order to do that, that mind must be united in the body. It can't be distracted by craving for and clinging to sensual objects, events, views, and ideas that are always external to the body. Is that clear how our minds work that way? And so we're never really present with our life as life occurs. And it's because of that lack of presence, mindful presence, with our life as it's unfolding, that is the underlying cause of all stress and suffering. We're simply not here. And so the Buddha, and again, these other things that the Buddha's talking about, these extreme views that he recognized that people indulged in back then and is just as common today, are just that. We seek sensual indulgence, sensual pleasure, because it fulfills the need for self-identification in the moment, and it makes us feel good. And the other extreme of, because that doesn't work all the time, some people take that extreme that I'm not going to have anything to do with life. I'm going to withdraw. And we do that through all different ways. Some of it through addiction, some of it through workaholism or other types of compulsive behavior. Sometimes it's the it's what certain neuroses give us. I learned something years ago, and it was from I was going to say it was from a therapist, but it wasn't. It was from Father Ken, Brother Ken. You've heard me talk about. He said, if you want to understand why people fall into certain behaviors, look at what the behavior gives them. And he was talking in a backhanded way about getting me to look at myself and my behavior. But that really hit me, how behaviors, even behaviors such as there's something wrong with me, bring a certain benefit. It allows me to not take certain responsibilities. And this is really what Brother Ken was getting at a long, long time ago. And this is the essence of ignorance, isn't it? To not take responsibility for how we are feeling, how we're thinking, how we're acting in the world. Oftentimes, if our actions or our words are less than peaceful, we make excuses for them. But all of it is this lack of responsibility rooted in ignorance of who I truly am. Getting back to what the Buddha is teaching, how can I take complete responsibility for myself if I'm not here? I have to first be here, don't I? And how do we do it? Through a meditation practice that develops deep concentration and developing the framework of the Eightfold Path, which puts us right where we are, free of any distraction that it needs to be any different than it is. Leads to calm, leads to self-awakening. Just to go back to that. The Buddha continues, I teach the truth of dukkha, the truth of stress, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of stress. Nothing more. That's enough, though. And then the Buddha teaches, what is stress? This is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful, sorrow, regret, pain is, and distress, pain, distress and despair are stressful. Furthermore, association with the unbeloved is stressful, and separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is craved for is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. We talked about that. The five clinging aggregates are simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering, as the Buddha describes that. Now remember the setting. This is the Buddha's very first teaching, and he's teaching this to these five guys that he knows are sincere in developing an understanding. And he's getting right to the point. And this monk's is a noble, well, not monks yet, but he called them that. And this monk's is a noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming rooted in ignorance, and accompanied by passion and delight in becoming further ignorant, relishing now here and now there by craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. So that last line might be confusing, craving for non-becoming. It simply relates to that, an underlying teaching during the Buddha's time and common to this to our teachings, especially modern Buddhism, that there's no such thing as a self, and that ultimately we're all part of this cosmic, universal emptiness and void. That's craving for non-becoming. And again, the teachings of Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta ultimately ended right there. They taught you how to establish that within your own mind and then live your life from this place of nothingness. Of course, that's just another excuse for an escape, isn't it? The Buddha taught that that's just as hurtful, these acquired so-called higher levels of consciousness are just as much a distraction as any other distraction, chasing after some other sensual pleasure. It's all rooted in that. relishing now here and now there by craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming, these are my words, means compulsive seeking to establish a self rooted in ignorance in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. Craving here, craving there. Every thought, word, and idea that occurs to a self-referential ego self must contain a self-reference, or it contains great fear. One of the reasons why many people feel fear in the beginning of Dhamma practice is because, at least in that moment, it feels like you're losing yourself. It feels like annihilation, because you're not creating one thought following a next thought that is a self-referential thought. It's also a way of saying we're breaking conditioned thinking by doing that. That's one of the reasons why a meditation practice whose goal is for deepening concentration and nothing else is so effective in breaking that conditioned thinking, that need to continue one thought, clinging to the next thought that furthers ignorance, the essence of conditioned thinking. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, and the letting go of that very craving. Now, what's he referring to up until that point? Continued self-establishment rooted in wrong views. So it is that continued craving for self-establishment that is to be recognized and abandoned, but it's also the crux of the matter, isn't it? Laura and I had a little bit of a talk ancillary to that. And we keep coming up with reasons why the Dhamma doesn't work, or I'm too busy to do this, I'm too distracted. And the Buddha, those are rooted in extreme views, aren't they? Because they're rooted in the need for constant sensory fulfillment in the moment. Boredom is another aspect of that. A mind that is feeling boredom is a mind that is craving for distraction in the moment, further craving, further becoming. And the more that we can recognize that craving for further becoming and simply come back to what's occurring, whether it's on our cushion or simply in our life, the more we're inclining our minds towards awakening, the more we're engaging in the Eightfold Path and developing what every single human being wants, whether they realize it or not, if I can speak for all humanity, a calm and peaceful mind. I know when I think back to, I talked a little bit about my upbringing, I had a wonderful parents, mostly wonderful siblings, five of them, a great house, you know, Berkeley Heights, middle class, upper middle class. I had everything I needed and most of the things that I wanted, even though I was never satisfied. But I remember being in my mid-teens and being incredibly frustrated with my life. And I was, because it just didn't make sense. I had all the things that you need externally to be happy, but I was miserable. And I wasn't miserable because of my condition. The environment I was living in was wonderful. It's because I simply didn't understand what the hell was going on. And nobody was teaching me that. And it would be many, many years and many different Buddhist practices before I finally came to what the Buddha taught, and I realized that that initial frustration that I was feeling was at 15 years old was simply craving. I didn't have the frame of reference to know that yet, but what I was experiencing was craving for understanding. I was craving for my life and myself to be different than it was. And like most kids that age, I blame myself. And oftentimes it's put on children that there's something wrong with you when you're not acting perfectly. I won't get into that any further.
John.
Yes, sir.
There's a phrase in here that every time I read it, I can't make sense of.
Uh-oh.
The remainderless fading. What is remainderless?
There's nothing left. There's not a shred of ignorance left. There's not a shred of wrong views. There's not a shred of conditioned thinking. Nothing remains.
Well, it's an adjective. It says the remainderless fading.
Yes.
It fades away and nothing is left.
Yes.
And it's speaking specifically of wrong views or ignorance. The less applied to remainder, meaning there's nothing remaining. Is that clear? And it's just a translation.
I believe you.
Well, yeah, it refers to that. Whether the word itself is confusing, it means that we have recognized and abandoned all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Thanks for the question. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. And then he reiterates it. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And now he's describing to his five friends how he came to this understanding and why that's what he's teaching it now. He tells them that vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. And that's such an important line, because much of the adaptations and accommodations to what the Buddha taught and is prevalent today is the license taken by misapplying that one term, actually dismissing it. The Buddha is declaring to his friends, and now for all time, that these things have never been heard before. But what is often claimed is that the Buddha, the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught, was a path that was taught throughout endless eons. And of course, either the Buddha's lying, it's a mistranslation, or there's a misapplication of what he's taught. And of course, the Buddha says that consistently. This is a path never heard before, regards to things never heard before. Then he says, what is that then? What is it that has never been heard before? Dukkha occurs, the first noble truth. The most profound statement that an awakened human being could ever make, and it's that. Again, a little anticlimactic, wouldn't it? Couldn't you see it as that? Dukkha occurs. Of course, we all know that life is at times stressful. But again, you have to understand the entire context, because then he gets into the problem of suffering and how we can eliminate that.
Yeah, it seems like a bit weird. Somebody who spends half of his lifetime trying to find out about suffering, and then the conclusion that he comes to, oh, it just happens.
Yeah, but in a very profound way. It happens because of certain conditions. Then he says, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This noble truth of stress is to be understood. There's the profound statement. Rather than struggling against something that we shouldn't struggle against because it's there, rather than come up with intricate strategies to explain it away or excuse it, the Buddha simply says we need to understand it. Think back when what set the Buddha off was recognizing severe suffering for the first time. He saw it in the sick and dying people around him, and he saw it in the competitiveness and aggressiveness in the marketplace. And he set out to understand it.
And he also saw it in his own life.
And yes, and when you and so he came to that conclusion that simply having a human life is prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences, dukkha. There's no way out. All the other spiritual practices, including, I mentioned, Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta, the reason why they were so successful, and their teachings were based on the Vedas and the Upanishads, is because they provided a vehicle for people to escape themselves within their own minds, to establish a state of nothingness. They both taught something similar to that. Alara Kalama, the state of nothingness, Udeka Ramaputta, the state of non-perception or perception. Both sounds pretty nonsensical, and they ultimately are. But that's what the Buddha's referring to here too. Not living in some unreal quality of mind, but simply put ourselves in a human life, which is the only life we're having. And in that life, dukkha occurs. And dukkha is to be understood.
Do you think the translation of dukkha often causes some of the confusion? That, of course,
yeah,
the first four things he says, we all have, can't avoid it, come to understand it better, but it's the unsatisfactoriness of your life that is really what he's talking about. And then he's everything else is commentary about how to understand that not being satisfied.
Yes, and it's the more subtle levels of dissatisfaction that we tend to ignore, isn't it? So most people hear dukkha occurs as suffering occurs, and it's often presented just that way. And suffering can lead to immediately an extreme view, isn't it? Suffering is some kind of extreme experience. But what the Buddha is describing, and what you're pointing out, David, is that all of life's experiences are ultimately satisfying, unsatisfactory, if we're craving for those experiences to be different or we're clinging to those experiences to remain the same. They're both part of an unsatisfactory experience. Excuse me. And because we've created conditions on our own lives that our life must always be satisfactory, we create constant distraction. We're never a mind united in our body. And because of that constant distraction, there is stress, dukkha occurs. And we don't really want to face that fact. We want to think that we can create a scenario in our life that is somehow insulating ourselves from life's experience, rather than being completely immersed, understanding the nature of human life is that it's unsatisfactory, and to simply be present with that. And that doesn't mean that then every experience is unsatisfactory or bland. We were talking about that. Yeah. Ultimately, what the great reward of life is life itself. We're able to be mindfully engaged with whatever's occurring without the need for it to be any different. And so there's no disappointment. Is that where you're going with that too? And so that's really the again, it almost sounds too mundane, but when you realize all the other things that we get caught up in that create stress in our lives, it's the greatest refuge in the world. Seeing things as they really are, from wrong view to right view. Diminishing the importance of understanding dukkha is diminishing the importance of what an awakened human being awakened to, isn't it? But again, for many people, it sounds, you know, I need to have a cosmic understanding or a mystical understanding or whatever it might be, or engaging in certain practices that get me out of my body but make me feel good, or compulsive behaviors that do the same thing, rather than simply being here. Developing a way to have a well-concentrated mind free of any wrong view of what's occurring, and to maintain a calm and peaceful mind throughout my life, moment by moment. It's remarkable, isn't it? Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the third noble truth. The noble truth of stress has been understood. Now he's describing his experience to his five friends. Right? He awakened. He realized that suffering occurs. He explained to them that it was craving that originated the suffering. And now he's teaching them that, guess what? I found a way out. The noble truth of stress has been understood within me. He's also describing what we need to do with the four noble truths. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the origination of stress. First noble truth. The noble truth of the origination of stress is to be abandoned. Craving and clinging is to be abandoned. This noble truth of the origination of stress has been abandoned. Now he's describing actually completing these tasks. Is that clear? Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the cessation of stress is to be directly experienced. So important, isn't it? It's not something that's bestowed on us or given to us out of grace or merit. It's to be experienced. How do we do it? This noble truth of the cessation of stress has been directly experienced through the Eightfold Path. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed. He's referring to the Eightfold Path. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. He's both teaching how to do this and that the conclusion of it is to develop the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of individual contributions to stress and suffering. Friends, as long as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was not pure, I did not claim to have directly self-awakened. My self-awakening is now unexcelled in the cosmos, even with its deities, its Maras, and Brahmins, with its contemplatives and other Brahmins, its royalty, and its common folk. He's just declaring that this is a path that nobody else has ever found before. But as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was truly pure, then I did claim to have directly self-awakened, an awakening unexcelled in the cosmos. Knowledge and vision arose in me, unprovoked is my release. This is the last breath. Another word for unprovoked would be unconditioned. He's let go of all views rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. And again, in context, no further becoming ignorant. He's let go of all those wrong views. Unprovoked is my release, my words. Release refers to the emptiness of ignorance in the Buddha's mind. Having become empty of ignorance, there is no longer the condition present, ignorance, to provoke craving, clinging, or any thought, word, or deed rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. And that last line, this is my last birth, refers to a physical birth, but most importantly, the next line, it points to there's nothing left in an awakened human being to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, a mind resting in peace and equanimity. Once that state was achieved, the Buddha states there is now no further becoming, meaning, again, there's nothing left in the Buddha to become further ignorant. He has developed a recognition and an abandonment of all views rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. He has released himself from clinging to those views. And he teaches others to become, as he described, rightly self-awakened. This is what the Buddha said. The group of five were delighted at his words. While this discourse was being given, Kandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Kandana understood at a very profound level the nature of impermanence, and most specifically, the nature of his own conditioned thoughts, words, and ideas, that they were all conditioned in ignorance. And those thoughts that arise rooted in condition are subject to impermanence, they're subject to cessation. Having heard Kandana's declaration, the Buddha exclaimed, so you really know, Kandana, you really know. You are now Anakandana, the one who understands. That's the end of the sutta. That last line, again, is a very important point in the Dhamma, that it points to the underlying insight that we're to gain through the Eightfold Path, and that's insight into the three marks of existence, and specifically in that case, to the impermanence of all things, but most importantly, the impermanence of wrong views of self. They can come to cessation. And once we do that, then we free ourselves from the nature of suffering, from disappointing experiences. From a self-referential point of view, that view is never satisfied. It's always disappointed in some way. There's always that underlying stress. Recognizing and abandoning those views that give rise to wrong views of self brings a cessation of individual contributions to dukkha. Let's talk. Thank you. Any questions or comments before we go around the room? Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. It's always a very good sutta to hear. Speaking very directly, obviously. And just what a auspicious day for mankind it was to... The Buddha just started his teachings. That was the day that it all started.
Yeah.
You know, what a wonderful day it is.
Yeah.
It was for all mankind, really. It's been very good for me to sort of come to class today. I missed on Saturday. I was away for a few days and missed the class and kind of let my practice slip and completely lost the train of thought of keeping a calm mind. But I can see that now that I'm sort of back with my feet on the ground again, I think I disregarded my practice more than I realised I was disregarding it. But obviously, that period of time has passed and off we go again. So, back again. But it really makes a difference when you are mindful of your mind and the clinging and the possibilities of clinging and the realization of what happens when you cling and wanting life to be different and all these little tricks that we learn here coming to class. It doesn't take long for you to slip back and lose the thread, and it really makes your mind a different mind than if you are coming to class and being mindful of the practice and being mindful of the teachings, and it makes a different mind. So I've just had a bit, maybe over the last few days, a reminder of that, and you know, it's important for your health and your well-being and your mind to keep at your practice.
Yeah.
And I think I've had a bit of an awakening of that. It's good to hear all the well-known phrases and thought processes that we learn here, and to be refreshed, and to it's been very good and very beneficial.
Thank you. Well said. And it's nice to know that the refuge is always here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the sutta. In fact, I can't remember exactly the right one because I'm writing three or four different ones at the same time. The Buddha says in there, in order to hear the Dhamma, you actually have to hear the Dhamma. You know, meaning you have to be in a position that you, and if you're not, you're not. You hear. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here again. Yeah, I've heard this super now, I don't know, 20 times.
Okay, you're going to hear it again pretty soon.
And I'm going to hear it again. And every time there's another thing that pops up and clarifies itself. Mm-hmm. This connection between the frustration and the craving. Just click for it. So I'm looking forward to being at the retreat. I'm going to hear it again. Some other things
are going to
fall into this.
Yeah. Thank you. And it is just that way, isn't it? You know, no matter how many times we hear the basics, there's always more to understand. It's just, yeah. The I don't want to get sidetracked with that. Mary, good to see you.
I'm good to be here. Good to see everyone. I wish everyone well on the retreat.
Thank you.
I've been there on the next one. I mean, this is an outstanding sutta, very grounding. I just traveled to Chicago for 2 days and was there this morning, got off the plane and came here. And I was able to maintain the practice and stay very present with my mindfulness and the Eightfold Path. And even though I was traveling with a colleague, it was, you know, still very comfortable to find the time in your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have more time when you're traveling. You're,
yeah,
you know, on the tarmac, so what are you going to do? You know, is there something you can read? I had downloaded some things onto my phone so I could use it when I didn't have Wi-Fi and things like that. So even though it was a whirlwind trip, just went yesterday and came back today, you know, it was very pleasant, very peaceful, and it meant that I was present for someone on my team, that it was kind of an honor to be able to take her and travel with her to this other site and to be present for her and with that one-on-one time and all of that. So you know, it matters, and everything tying back into, like, you can see the nuances of how you're living the Dhamma because of the Eightfold Path. You know, like, you could go into life trying to be more pleasant and compassionate and all these other things, I imagine, but without the path to hold you accountable for, you know, when you might be slipping out of, or letting your ego slip into something without going into a lot of detail. I just experienced that where I was able to catch something and something very subtle and just stay on the path and have a more effective outcome. So, joyful engagement of the dog.
Thank you. That's beautiful. You've developed the qualities of mind that allow you to be in the world and yet be free of stress. That's the Dhamma, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, again, it might seem too mundane to people, but I don't think you'd give it up for anything, would you?
No. I think Warren has said something this past week about the, she was sort of in a laughing fit, you know, it was the simplicity of it all,
yeah.
Right? But the difficulty too. But yes, it's true.
Yeah, it is utterly simple and utterly practical,
mm-hmm.
But our minds are we're caught up in that feedback loop.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of
effort. And it's having the direct experience of it.
Yeah.
And it's the come and see for yourself.
It is the only way.
Right.
Because it's the only way you'll know it, and you'll hopefully continue it once you have some experience of it. And it's really the only way you can share it with others when the situation arises. You can't share this unless you have the actual experience of it.
Right, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I'm glad this was the teaching tonight, because going into retreat, it's just kind of gets it rolling again.
Yeah.
And each time I hear it, it means something different, because the context of all your other teachings always keeps it based on the middle way, and it really frames your life.
Yeah.
It just becomes what you are. Ram and I have said it multiple times that it's just what you become.
Yeah.
And, you know, my practice is it's an every moment thing. It's not a twice a day thing I have to do. I have to read. It's just the way I am now. And thank you.
Thank you for describing a well-integrated Dhamma practice. That's what it is. It's not just on our cushions occasionally. We develop that development of right view. We see things, see ourselves in relation to the world around us, always from a point of view of right view, or developing right view. You know, when we're not, if we've developed a framework of the Eightfold Path, we know, and Laura and I talked about this a little earlier too, we know when we're in wrong view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what do? Come into right view. Thank you, David. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, too. The practice of sitting for today is really real good, because I heard something a little bit differently tonight about not just looking at the Eightfold Path as a framework and understanding what each of them can provide, but it's like so that the view really to see, not just see the behavior or see what you're doing, but to understand it when it's sort of, for example, for when it gets in the way, if it feels like ego, to be able to recognize it so closely, much closer to the moment. Doesn't mean that, you know, it's as skillful as I want it to be, but and this clarity has been really helpful.
Thank you for describing it that way. We are gaining an understanding of the root cause of why we want things to be different than they actually are. Mm-hmm. Another way of just saying we're going from wrong view to right view. Thank you, Liz. Good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. It's good to be here. I wish you guys all well on the retreat. I think it's just so nice to be able to set that time aside. And, I will miss not knowing, but moment. You know, it's the idea of, as part of the practice, the Buddha says to meditate twice a day, and then after, or at that moment, when you become awakened, you get to continue your practice of sitting twice a day.
Yeah.
So it's very simple. It's, you know, but even in terms of not having a most auspicious moment of not catching feelings arising and when things happen in a millisecond, to know that the next thing you need to do is just to be kind to yourself and to start at the beginning sort of again and, you know, and just move on from there. It's quite a relief.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend a lot of time wallowing in your own guilt for having made a mistake or whatever. You can just say, okay, I'm just going to move on.
Wow.
You know, so it's good. It's a relief.
Thank you. It is. It's the ultimate, in that way, it's the ultimate escape, isn't it? But it's an escape into reality, not from reality. And it is it's a relief to finally get there. You started by saying, it's such a beautiful way of putting it, you have the confidence of knowing what to do next.
Yeah.
Because you're living within a framework. You know you're good to go because you know that you're acting within this framework that just simply works. And it's not a confidence that's born out of arrogance. It's a confidence born out of wisdom.
And of having seen it for yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's, you know, the Buddhist would sometimes describe himself as the peaceful sage. That's what we become. You know, it seems wise to not be entangled in the world, you know, because it is.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate in wisdom.
Yeah,
that's what the Buddha says, you've left the world behind. It doesn't mean that you've gone to some other planet or you've vanished. You're simply not entangled, as we talked about Saturday too. We're not entangled in the world anymore. We have, and because of that, we have the confidence of knowing that whatever comes, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I understand, as Kandana said, I understand that all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Thank you. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here tonight. Yeah, it's great teaching. I think that for me, I struggled today a little bit with wrong view. I was well aware that I was in wrong view. And with that moment of awareness, when you realize that it's caused from ignorance, and the in your reading there, you have something in there about the impermanence of conditioned phenomena is what causes, you know, the craving and clinging.
Yeah.
And it has a cause, like, and that cause is based in ignorance of what it is that I'm trying to remember, so I'm not ignorant, and to understand that I'm in wrong view, and to understand that the whole purpose of right view is to just know stress, to know its origination, to know that your cessation, and to know the path leading to it. And that if I set my intention to abandon wrong view, then I'm on my way, you know? And it's like, and sometimes it can get like mentally overwhelming and exhausting when I have a real busy day and I'm just dealing with very needy people who have no clue that they are in ignorance, innocently. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
And I can see it. And you know what I mean? I can see it in them, and I can see it in myself, and I'm like, this is too much. You know what I mean? It's like, I need a break. I need refuge. I need to go sit in meditation for 5 minutes and breathe. And it's cool. Like Liz said, it's good to know what to do next.
Yeah.
And what Lorna taught me last week was that if your mind is disturbed, you know you're in wrong view. So I had a very bumpy ride today, so I had some dookie going on.
But what a clear understanding, too. Thank you, Lorna, for that. And thank you, Frank. the difficulties you had in today's world are not because of, and I know you're not saying this, it's not because of a lack of Dhamma practice, it's simply the way the world is, isn't it? So the confusion and delusion that's present in the world doesn't stop simply because we're so wonderful that we've awakened. It's still there. And one of the reasons why we take refuge on our cushion is to at least to, for those 20 or 30 minutes, to separate ourselves from the world in a direct and physical way. It's just like that. But we carry this refuge with us wherever we go, too.
It was a real busy day at work, and my partner was away taking her daughter back down to Myrtle Beach. And
today?
Today, yeah. She's got clients that she has to see.
Boy.
And it was a rough go for them too. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for bringing that up. And yeah, it was just today was my watch the news day. And I heard it was. I wasn't ignorant of the fact that there was a huge hurricane down there. But man, I showed a helicopter flying over 20 miles inland, and it was just. The whole state, I don't know, that's something, it's kind of unprecedented, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy. I don't even know why I talked about that. It's not to dismiss the suffering that all those people, I mean, millions of people are going through. But just to make the point about what we're talking about, when the Buddha talks about dukkha occurs, he's talking about all types, from the minor disappointments that we have to things like that. And so there's no way that anybody that was there could have avoided that. Nobody can control the weather. The only thing that we can do in a situation like that is the same thing that we can do when we don't get the second piece of chocolate cake, is not take it personally. But in the context of the chocolate cake, it doesn't really have much consequences. But in the context of a major disaster that you find yourself a part of, and still be able to maintain a measure of mindful presence, can only be helpful, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I just to use that as an extreme, and I probably shouldn't use other people's extreme suffering as an example, but it's just such a good one. We all kind of discussed or talked about in different ways the practical application of the Dhamma, and that's just how it should be. One of the reasons I've had a few people say that they don't come back to class because they don't like all the talk, especially afterwards, and I can understand that, I guess. But it's in the discussion that we're here helping each other and understanding that we're actually developing the Dhamma. It's not just some, you know, game that we're playing. We're actually doing it. And that's remarkable. We're developing the benefit. We're developing a common, peaceful mind using a system, if I can use the word, that was developed first 2,600 years ago and first presented in this sutta tonight. And it's just as relevant today as it was then, isn't it? Remarkable. I look forward to seeing three of you on Thursday. I'll miss the rest of you. As long as technology allows, there's no bugs, I'll be streaming the classes, so if you want to pick them up. The schedule is in today's email, and it's on the streaming website, too, when those classes will be.
That's just to hear you.
Pardon me?
Just to hear it.
Well, here, watch it. It'll be on YouTube. Yeah, and then I'll post the talks, too. One of the reasons why I was dropping the audio is they just started letting you use chat directly with YouTube Live, and I enabled it, but it wasn't working right, and no, that's when the thing was not working correctly, when I was losing the audio. But I might try it again on retreat if anybody wants to interact.
I think you need a drone, John.
I do.
A little drone.
Yeah.
To fly around in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be very distracting.
No. I need it, but I would need a pilot, though, right?
Yeah.
Bonnie said they could deliver pizza with the drums.
Really? From Galasso's? Okay. So I think that's it. I think that's all we have tonight. Any other questions or comments? We're so fortunate to have the Buddha's Dhamma still here. So we'll finish, as we always do, with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and become mindful of the You're in breathing and you're out breathing. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.